open borders. You hear some people advocating almost that when they argue for much, much higher levels of immigration. And when you listen to them, you'd think that more people just means there's going to be more money in the country, the economy will lift, everything will be okay. But of course, in fact, it's a more complicated story than that. My own perspective is you can't have open borders and just let anyone in. And in particular, I'm a fan of our skilled migration program, but not just me. This has been a bipartisan policy between Liberal and Labor for as long as I can remember. Let's bring in people who are skilled, who can do the jobs that we need. But we're not alone in that. Some of our Asian neighbours have absolutely thrived with very tightly controlled immigration programs. Joining me now to talk about just that is William Hill, a contributor to The Spectator, who recently wrote an article, How Asia Thrives Without Open Borders. William, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, what is the story in Asia?
Well, immigration to Asia has been very limited, particularly in the pre-1990s. Since that time, they've had a very, as you say, strictly controlled program of inviting in, under very strict labour conditions, people with a more advanced sets of skills, people with high-level experience in private business, people in education, people to teach English. They bring people in without the sort of pathway to either citizenship or permanent residency that immigrants or workers coming into either Australia, the United Kingdom, the European Union, or the United States enjoy.
So while we might have in common with many of these countries a skilled migration requirement, I mean, as you know, Australia thrives on skilled migration. We have elements of our program that don't require that. Our refugee program, for example, which is also has bipartisan support. But for direct migration to Australia, it's skilled. But you're saying the difference between us and them is we do allow for skilled migration a pathway to permanent residence and to citizenship, and that the Asian countries might not allow that.
Yes, one of the most interesting things about the countries of East Asia, I make no comment about the other parts of Asia, is that naturalisation, so the process of entering a country, working there, and then becoming a citizen, is incredibly rare and quite restricted. If you look at the figures, they have increased a little bit since the 1990s, but before that, you didn't see it that much. So in Korea, in the 30 or 40 years before the year 2000, only about a couple of dozen people were naturalized. So a person who was born overseas and then becomes a Korean citizen. Since that time, you have seen a bit of an increase in that, but it's still comparatively very small. Same for Japan, same for China, same for Taiwan.
Is it true on the other side of it that we're in competition with other countries for these highly skilled people? Well, we agree on the skill bit, but for the really highly skilled, we're in competition. So, for example, a country that has more generous family reunion opportunities might attract a brain surgeon from the United Kingdom, and a country that says, well, we want you, we want your wife and your kids, but you're not bringing your mum, and she might be the sole, you know, surviving relative back home, that brain surgeon will say, well, I'm going somewhere else where I can take my mother. So there is an element, isn't there, where immigration policy can be used to attract the right people to Australia.
Oh, absolutely. And a high-level brain surgeon bringing his family doesn't seem like much of a price to pay if you can get that high-level brain surgeon to work in one of your hospitals. I think that's a good thing. If I was the country on the receiving end, I'd say the more the merrier. There are two problems with that, though. What about the country that needs that high-level brain surgeon as well? A lot of developing countries do actually have a shortage of high-end people, particularly in the medical profession. We take the doctor from them. I think we should be concerned about what the effect is for the people at that end of the equation as well. And also,
well, let me just say, we might. It's good that you can have these discussions where we can disagree in a civil fashion. I, as you know, had the immigration job and I thought long and hard about this, and I do disagree with you. And the reason I disagree is I don't think you can go to third world countries and say, yes, look, we want you to go to school. There might not have been opportunities in the past, but there are now. And you too can be a brain surgeon. And then when he or she gets to that point, say, but unlike every other brain surgeon who's wanted on the international stage, we're not going to have you. You have to stay where you are. I think the problems in the third world countries, a shortage of specialists, needs to be fixed, but not by penalising the specialists that grow up there and making them stay there. And there are other ways to do that. I just think individual effort needs to be rewarded. And if they want to get out and get away and then maybe go back, well, we shouldn't stop them. from my point of view, if you're sitting in the immigration minister's desk, your job is, now careful, I've got to be careful in case I sound like a Trump fan, is to put Australia first and say what is in Australia's best interest. That's your job. You're not the keeper of the rest of the world.
No, I agree with that as well. I think there are limits to how humanitarian and global-minded you can be, and to put the interest of your own people first is a good thing. And like, as I said, for Australia to get the brain surgeon, as you mentioned, or the other highly skilled person, is a plus and a good thing for Australia, as it is for Japan or, say, South Korea, to get the very good Australian English teacher to go over there to help their kids learn English. But as I said, there are costs to that. And I think one of the costs that people don't consider so much is the effect of robbing a lot of developing countries of their most highly skilled people, people who they need to lift their human development indexes.
I'm talking with William Hill, who's written an article for The Spectator on how Asia thrives without open borders. William, we're talking about having skilled migration without directly mentioning one of the benefits. We've indirectly done it by mentioning the brain surgeon, and that is we didn't pay for his education. Some other country did, and we get the benefit of it. Now, that is one of the great benefits of a skilled migration program, not only that you get the skills you need so that you're, look, it might be an IT firm, a manufacturing firm, a graphics design firm, whatever. They can get on with their job and make money. That's why you bring the skilled people in, to let people make money so they can pay taxes so we can do good things. But you also bring in a very high level of education that creates, a different environment. Kids in Australia grow up and go to, neighbourhood parties, etc., where there are brain scientists and neurophysicists and, IT workers and whatever. It's a different cultural climate that you bring kids into when they come into a world that's cluttered with skilled people, and other people have paid for those skills, not us. So that's definitely a benefit, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree that definitely is a benefit. I think that the consequence of rapidly increasing your population, however, isn't felt by people sort of in the higher economic strata. I think it's really felt by people in the bottom two-thirds, and especially the bottom third. Kelvin Thompson, as you know, was a former parliamentary colleague of yours who's considered population issues very seriously his whole life, said that he was in no doubt that high levels of immigration adversely affected the wage and income conditions of people at the bottom part of the society. And that includes, by the way, the migrants who have already come. A lot of migrants come to Australia, particularly students who have graduated from Australian universities. They'd also paid a lot for their education here. When they enter the workforce, they face quite adverse conditions. If you keep increasing the people competing at the lower income part of the economy, I think you create quite negative effects for the people. And as I said, that includes the migrants who are already here.
I have to say, people with degrees don't see themselves as the bottom of the economy, and people without degrees certainly don't see people with degrees as being at the bottom. But the
That's
point
true,
you
but
make...
the question, the double-edged sword there is whether their degree actually translates into a middle-income job straight away. There's a lot of evidence that a lot of graduate people who maybe don't have the best language skills, they've got the degree, but they're not actually getting into that sort of job that they want. That's why you've seen an explosion of, casualisation in... parts of the economy, people who have accounting degrees working in supermarkets, so these sorts of things. I think that needs to be addressed a bit more.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's a function of universities, though. It defies belief to me that you can get a master's in information technology, but I can have dinner with you and struggle to have a flowing conversation because you need to think and listen to what I've said in English, and you need to think to respond back. And I have dinner with you and I understand you're never going to get a job in IT because you're not going to be able to communicate with customers.
Yes, absolutely. I live in Canberra. There's a large population of Chinese students here, and a lot of them are having a lot of difficulty and they face real problems in the workforce. A lot of them I know, they are paid cash in hand. They're not paid properly. They don't have tax file numbers. They don't get the same sorts of benefits that they deserve and that they are entitled to. It's not the fault of the people who have come here. They've come here for good reasons and they've come here to make a great contribution. They are being failed by the education and training policies, which is about bringing in huge amounts of people and then not skilling them correctly.
But see, that's not an immigration policy. That's an education policy. That's my point. It's not the number of people there. It's that they're inadequately trained.
I believe that the number of people exacerbates that problem, however. I think it's
I think it's the university not wanting to spend the money training them. That's what I reckon it is.
Well, as my article suggested, in the case of China and less so in the case of South Korea, they already have a substantial population of people who aren't that skilled and are still in the sort of like floating economy, you might call it, over there. By increasing the amount of people in the country, particularly from lower incomes, they would make that problem worse. They're trying to deal with the problem that they have. I think it's the same in Australia.
William, a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure talking to you.
That was William Hill, contributor to The Spectator and recent author of the article How Asia Thrives Without Open Borders.